are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood. This book was reviewed by Jumana Khatib. True to its form, this quietly unsettling Australian novel, a finalist for this year's Booker Prize, burrows quickly and deeply into the spiritual consciousness of its unnamed narrator. She's an atheist, an adult orphan, a dedicated steward of the earth, seeking retreat. These conditions are enough to propel her from her house, marriage, and job in Sydney to a convent near her childhood home on a highland in New South Wales. Her move is less an act of giving up than of giving in to the years of unending grief after the death of her parents, to her practically animal need for withdrawal. Her observations are as keen as an osprey's. On the sister's grounds, she notes early in her first day, the silence is so thick, it makes me feel wealthy. Then come three practically biblical events: a mouse infestation, the delivery of a dead nun's remains after her mysterious death overseas, and the arrival of a woman from the narrator's past, which elicits hot waves of shame, along with an astute moment of recognition by the narrator about her environment. Everyone here has hurt someone by coming, she says. I can't call the narrator's voice affable, not quite. She is companionable, alive to her circumstances, awake in all senses. Joining the convent for her is neither exactly an abdication of the material world nor an expression of faith in the spiritual one, but it makes for engaging reading. The narrator's feelings might best be summed up by the grace note she offers after confessing her uneasiness about the Catholic Church's legacy and how it tramples on her own values. Yet here I am. Wrestle, wrestle. Carnality by Lena Wolfe. This book was also reviewed by Jumana Khatib. Nietzsche says man is evil, but woman is mean. What kind of nun would coat something like that? Meet Lucia, the thumbless sister and religious authority behind a reality TV show with a rabid fan base and rather exigent morality clause. Look, no possible plot synopsis will satisfy the questions you are sure to have. This is a story of a Scandinavian woman in Madrid, sweating through her fascia in peak summer heat, who invites a shady character named Mercuro to crash at her rented flat. Mercuro is a rake with all the charm of a mongoose, who's coincidentally on the run from the aforementioned Lucia, a bloodthirsty nun with a score to settle. Some books you read for coherence, hospital corners, faultless plating. Others you read for the pyrotechnics and jump scares, the tickles of your psyche's dark and forgotten corners. Obviously, this one, translated from the Swedish by Frank Perry, is in the latter camp, a sort of glossy and insane brochure that shows you the outcome of decisions you would, under no circumstances, make. Lucia's colleague sums up their TV project neatly. People can turn to us with their problems of the flesh, and we will help them find their souls. Sounds like The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, but juicier. Would watch. The reviewer, Jumana Khatib, is a senior staff editor at the New York Times. She is multilingual and speaks four languages. Sister Deborah by Scholastique Mukasonga, translated by Mark Polizotti. This book was reviewed by V.V. Ganeshanathan. In Scholastique Mukasonga's new novel, Sister Deborah, Black American evangelists arrive in 1930s Rwanda with good tidings. A Black savior, perhaps a celestial woman, is coming to the village of Niabikanke, and soon to bring Black people a bountiful harvest and salvation. The chief bearer of this joyful message is the eponymous healer prophet, a charismatic woman of mysterious origin and powers who can speak in tongues. Her powerful black feminist vision earns her scores of women followers. This book is not only her tale, but also theirs. As they search, strive, wait, and hope, they disrupt their own lives as well as long-standing systems of patriarchy and colonialism. And this remarkable recursive book about the power of belief, like its heroines, finds new form again and again. The four-part story begins in the voice of Ikaireze, a Rwandan-born scholar in the United States, looking back on her childhood near Niyabikenki to try to understand how she became the chronicler of Deborah's life. When Ikaireze is young, Deborah's presence prompts much debate in her community, especially among the men, and Ikaireze's father vilifies Deborah as a demonic fraud. The real priests, he says, are all white. But Ikaireze's mother, who believes in the medicine she learned from her maternal line, defies him to take her sickly little girl to the healer, and returns, certain that Sister Deborah's hands and metal cane had banished the worms feeding in my intestines, the spiders spinning their webs in my lungs, the evil spirits that had taken up residence in my brain. Among the men, Sister Deborah's prophecy carries a convincing urgency the white priest's sermons lack. These Americans, they argued, because they were black, had much better access to the spirits. Her followers' enthusiasm turns to armed rebellion as they attempt to enforce her calls for sexual abstinence and an end to farming as they await the arrival of their savior. Alarmed, the white colonial authorities send in soldiers to restore order. The clash results in Deborah's death or disappearance, depending on the teller. Decades later, Ikaireze notes that the official report limited itself to mentioning mobs of women, sporadic pillaging, uprooting of coffee plants, and the expulsion of the black American missionaries vaguely implicated in the matter. It did not mention Sister Deborah. It was as if she had never existed. But her colonizers' attempts to crush faith and edit history fail. In the second part, Ikaireze hears that Deborah's corpse rose from a ditch, that she defeated the soldiers, that she had returned to America. A reverend who came to Rwanda with Deborah is rumored to be preaching that at the end of days, Africans would be transported to the United States on the Black Messiah's cloud, and there everyone, or at least the reverend's faithful followers, would become white. One of her acolytes leads women into the forest to find Deborah resting in the form of a great tree. They never reemerge. I gathered up these scraps of tales, and I preserved them like precious jewels in the corner of my memory, not knowing then that it would be up to me, later, to tell the story of Sister Deborah, Ikaireze remembers. In a startling third section, the novel pivots with great force and beauty to Deborah's voice, addressing Ikaireze's directly, both insisting on her own version of the story and also cautioning against giving it too much authority. Her reflections on her visions and prophecies are among the book's most moving passages. Sometimes I tell myself the story was a dream, and at other times that it's indeed what happened, Deborah says. How can you see yourself in your dreams? Who is the dreamer? Who is being dreamed? Another writer might have stopped here, but Mukasonga forges on into near unimaginable future. In the final section, another act of violence drives Ikaireze to investigate Deborah's fate once more. The search presents Ikaireze with a surprising choice. But as Mukasonga writes, the existence of faith depends on waiting, not resolution, and in the end she offers no catharsis, only a dark and hopeful hall of mirrors. The reviewer, V.V. Ganeshanathan, is the author of the novels Brotherless Night and Love Marriage, and the co-host of the Literary Hub's fiction, non-fiction podcast. My Good Bright Wolf, a Memoir, by Sarah Moss. This book was reviewed by Sylvia Brownrigg. You won't think your way out of this, your therapist says. Sarah Moss writes towards the end of her powerfully original and unsettling memoir about anorexia. You have to act, and it will be difficult and uncomfortable, and you will have to do it consistently. By this point in a story that stretches from the English novelist's fraught childhood to her successes as author and professor, the reader is so relieved to hear a sympathetic voice addressing Moss that the therapist's simple, if painfully difficult, directive has a poignant resonance. Moss has indeed spent much of this inventive narrative trying to think her way through her illness, tracking its origins, personal and cultural, and has taken us down many brilliant pathways. But for her sake, we hope, finally, that she will also act. Some who write about anorexia's fierce compulsions address the disease as an addiction. For Moss, it is an endless argument, one that began, as it often does for girls, in adolescence, then roared back with near-lethal vengeance in her mid-40s. From early days, Moss had heard critical voices calling her greedy and troublesome, and she captures their harshness not just in passages about her eating, but also as an irritable chorus questioning her memoir's very project. The first of the book's three sections covers Moss's upbringing in the north of England with two self-involved withholding parents, her father, an American academic prone to occasional rages, her mother, a feminist fighting her own demons and passing along weight anxiety to her daughter. The narrator's memoirs of a household where care and attention are scarce resources, not to be wasted on the undeserving, are challenged by her italicized critic. Other people, eyewitnesses, would tell it quite differently. This story, you have no right, no right at all. You always make stuff up and you can't resist. The interruptions give the telling a staccato rhythm, but also convey the precarity of the writer's trust in her own experience. Moss's use of the second person through much of the book enhances this sense of distance. She switches to the third person in the central, most harrowing section, an account of her recent stay at a squalid, underfunded hospital when she was on the verge of organ failure. She used to sweat at moments of tension, but her body had turned off that function months ago. She employs fable-like names for family members. Her father is the owl, her mother, Jumbly Girl, her rarely mentioned brother, the angel child, as if this were more sinister fairy tale than a memoir, and evokes the title's imaginary wolf as her protector and a companion on journeys back to a younger self. Wolf, tell that little girl. Those are just feelings. You can manage them. Wolf, walk beside that fading girl. If Moss is forever suspicious of her body and its appetites, she is always content to feed her energetic mind by reading. She weaves literary analyses into her complex textured story. One of the few activities she did share with her mother, incidentally, is sewing and dressmaking. She revisits favorite authors from childhood, Laura Ingalls Wilder and Arthur Ransome, hunting for images of food and nurturing, and brings a feminist and anti-colonialist sensibility to the stories of women and their madnesses found in the works of the Brontes, Plath, and Wolfe. She wanders imaginatively along the peaks of the Lake District with Dorothy Wordsworth. Sarah Moss's eight novels include the short, suspenseful Ghost Wall and The Fell, a book I press on anyone who asks whether great fiction has been written about the pandemic. Fans of Moss's work will recognize in My Good Bright Wolf the ominous air of danger, the alertness to class issues, and the figure of a bright, spiky woman chafing against restrictions. They will discover the source of the author's passion for climbing mountains and the freedom she feels being outside in the natural world, which have found expressions in her novels. The last section, A Body of One's Own, Thinking, contains the story's lightest and darkest moments. Moss has the courage to capture, lyrically, the self-annihilating impulse at the heart of her predicament. If you were going to fall, this would be a good place. An anguish recognizable to many readers, not only those who suffer from anorexia. Saving her is the thought of her sons. Earlier in a description of a family hiking trip in Italy, Moss finally allows her husband and grown-up sons to appear and reveals herself as a caring, diligent mother. It is clear that Moss's family knows about her struggles when she has an anxious flare-up after an encounter with an angry stranger. In a loving gesture, her older son puts his hot hand on her sweaty shoulder. He knows he cannot drive out his mother's self-critical voices, but we feel the touch itself as a comfort. The reviewer, Sylvia Brownrigg, is the author of 7 works of fiction and The Whole Staggering Mystery, A Story of Fathers Lost and Found. Dear Run Home by Anne Claire Lazat. This children's book was reviewed by Sarah Novick. Life is spiraling out of control for 12-year-old Effie, the protagonist of Anne Claire Lazat's Dear Run Home. In Spare, first-person free verse, we glimpse Effie's world where social and emotional isolation is the norm. Though she is deaf and uses American Sign Language, or ASL, no one in her family has learned to sign. At public school, engagement with peers and teachers is mediated through an ASL interpreter, Miss Kathy. As a result, Effie suffers from language deprivation, a condition about which Lazat provides information in the postscript. Language deprivation occurs when a person does not reach fluency in at least one language within the critical window for acquisition, approximately birth to age 5. While preventable, once it occurs, its cognitive effects are pervasive and permanent. In the United States, less than 8% of hearing parents learn enough ASL to hold a two-way conversation with their deaf child, and an estimated 70% of deaf children experience a degree of language deprivation. Things turn bleaker for Effie when the COVID-19 pandemic forces instruction online, and her school declines to integrate ASL interpretation into its remote learning platform, leaving her to complete stacks of worksheets alone. Trapped at home where no one understands her, Effie is especially vulnerable to predation, and in a poem titled That Summer, Dark Shadows, she recalls an instance of sexual assault by her stepfather. Deaf children are 2 to 3 times more likely than hearing children to undergo sexual abuse. Effie and her sister Deja are sent away to live with their father, an alcoholic who fails to provide basic food and care for them. My communication with Daddy is him stomping on the floor, pointing to things, Effie relates. He gets annoyed if I sign. He doesn't have the patience to write, unless it's 1 or 2 words, or a joke without all the lines. At their father's trailer, Effie fixates on the safety of the surrounding deer population, who are being forced from their habitats by new home construction. She takes special interest in a deer she nicknames Golden Eyes, who is often by himself. Deer are supposed to be herd animals. Why is he alone? She wonders. In the deer's predicament, loss of home, the world closing in, Effie sees her own. A new school year begins, but Effie is repeating the 5th grade. For many language-deprived people, obtaining language fluency outside the critical window is exponentially harder, and diminished executive function and secondary learning disabilities are also common. Effie is surprised to find comfort in a kind English teacher who encourages her to explore poetry, despite her imperfect way of writing English. Like the words go in sign. In math, though, she is drowning, unable to translate word problems into numerical form. Language deprivation isn't inherent to deafness. Deaf children, given consistent access to a signed language from infancy, can achieve age-expected language milestones alongside their hearing peers. Mary Lambert, the protagonist of Lazat's Show Me a Sign trilogy, sent on Martha's Vineyard in the 19th-century village of Chilmark, which has unusually high incidence of deafness and its own sign language shared by deaf and hearing residents alike, serves as an example of this. In Mary's words, the same journey can be more or less difficult depending on where you start. Like Effie, Mary is deaf and has a penchant for writing. But unlike her, Mary has had lifelong language access in her family and community. She narrates her world with the complexity and wit that Effie's voice intentionally lacks. As Effie's neglect by her family becomes increasingly evident, Miss Kathy files for emergency full-time custody, and a hearing ensues. As often happens when adults are seen through the eyes of children, Miss Kathy is a bit of an enigma. Questions about the often paternalistic field of special education and the ethics of interpreters intervening in the lives of clients remain uninterrogated. Lizotte's work has touched on these issues before. Mary Lambert pulls no punches in discussing the injustices of life on her island. Calling out missionaries and educators on their saviorism is a theme of the trilogy's third book, Sail Me Away Home. In Deer Run Home, Lizotte employs a significantly softer touch. Effie's friend, Kate, a wheelchair user with cerebral palsy, expresses her displeasure with a condescending aide. But Miss Kathy's bid to rescue Effie from her family is viewed as a wholly positive endeavor. While this feels true to Effie's wishful perspective, courtroom scenes might have afforded readers an opportunity to take in the bigger picture. That Effie is hardly a firebrand in the face of her trauma is understandable, and perhaps essential in terms of what she might represent for today's deaf children. Not to mention the fact that, as Lizotte's author's note reveals, Effie's story is based on a real 1995 adoption case. If Effie's pain is real, so too might be her hope. The novel begins and ends with allusions to the myth of Iphigenia, King Agamemnon's daughter, who the goddess Artemis demanded he sacrifice to her in return for killing one of her favorite deer. The final poem reminds us that she was rescued in the end. The pyre was built, the flames rose, but a stag replaced her. Through Effie, young readers, both deaf and hearing, will encounter a heartfelt homecoming story and reassurance that they are not alone. The reviewer, Sarah Novick, is author of the novels True Biz and Girl at War. She's also an instructor of deaf studies and creative writing. Dinner for Vampires, Life on a Cult TV Show, While Also in an Actual Cult, by Bethany Joy Lenz. This book was reviewed by Fran Huffner. Bethany Joy Lenz knows cults have gone a little mainstream. When I tell someone I was in a cult, their first response is, "Which one?" She writes in her sharp confessional memoir, Dinner for Vampires, people are hoping she'll say one they recognize from a Netflix documentary. I see the disappointment on their faces when I say, just a small Bible-based group in the Pacific Northwest. It may not be a household name, but that group, known as the Big House Family, preyed upon Lenz's psychological and financial well-being for a decade, leeching her of any perceived free will. Before she became famous for her 9-year run as the geeky but charming overachiever Haley James in the 2000s TV drama One Tree Hill, Lenz was a Hollywood newcomer looking for community. Dinner for Vampires rejects the stereotype that only the naive and broken can fall victims to a cult's seduction. Raised by loving and devout hippie Christians who moved frequently, she spent most of her upbringing in Texas and divorced when she was 16. Lenz remembers a household filled with prayer, proverbs, and daily conversations about God. Her father read a leather-bound King James Bible with a highlighter and pen nearby, filling every inch of margin with impeccably written notations. Committed, but never obsessive or manipulative in their faith, her parents made room for their daughter's aspirations, defending her, for instance, when the church took issue with her role in the tawdry daytime soap opera Guiding Light. Lenz's prose remains light and clear, and often funny throughout the book, even when it takes a disturbing turn. Arriving in Los Angeles at 20 to pursue her acting career in earnest, she feels so isolated and unmoored that she seeks out other young Christians for companionship, one of whom leads her to a weekly Bible study in the home of two brothers, former Seventh-day Adventists. There, she meets a man she calls Les, a pastor without a flock from Idaho, whose odiousness she describes vividly. A short red-faced man in his late 40s, with hair everywhere except the top of his head, and a stomach that ballooned forward under apish arms. Les visits the group regularly for months, wresting control of the L.A. Bible Study Group and turning it into a subsidiary of the church he is building back home. The denomination he practices is never specified, and the fuzzy details of his past and of his doomed business ventures propel the memoir, even if some mysteries remain unsolved. Depressed after a heartbreak, Lenz has grown sympathetic enough to Les's influence that she accepts an invitation to visit the Little God Spa. Les and another leader, Pam, are building up in Idaho. I needed to be surrounded by family. As her trips there accumulate, this family starts to take the place of her own so-called bio-family. The more I folded into Les and Pam's world, Lenz writes, the more misunderstood by my parents I felt, and the less I trusted them. After a couple of years in L.A., Lenz moves to Wilmington, North Carolina to shoot One Tree Hill, worrying her work will dilute her faith, even as members of the family start showing up in Wilmington for impromptu group sessions. As Les continues to infiltrate every aspect of Lenz's life, her acting career funds his ministry and his motel, she manages his restaurant, she marries his son, rumors start to swirl among the show's fans. When a family member admits she's been stealing money from her, Lenz thinks, by now I'd be sufficiently groomed that the only correct response was to forgive her. When she gives birth to her daughter, Rosie, Lenz's bio mom isn't allowed to be there. Only Les and his wife are present. By the time One Tree Hill finishes shooting in 2011, Lenz dreads returning to Idaho. Home was now a wayward ship with terror-stricken passengers. By now, conflict has erupted within the group and in her marriage. When another couple quits the family, Lenz feels permission to think differently. This small awakening grows into the resolve to walk away from the family once and for all in 2012. Her internal rebellion, self-conscious and faith-driven, turns outward. She takes the family to court for custody of Rosie and for the money she lost on their poor investments. Lenz movingly presents her awakening as a kind of baptism and also a return. She feels subsumed by a voice she recognizes from her adolescence, the same warm, loving presence it had been all those years ago. I'd know it anywhere. I had been chasing it for 10 years in all the wrong places. The reviewer, Fran Huffner, is a freelance cultural critic living in Brooklyn. She writes the newsletter Fran Magazine. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.